In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Kind of scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
We walk up to them and confront them. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News. I'm Jeff Brady. Among the many ecological challenges faced on planet Earth, climate engineering, real-time aerosol operations, and the manipulation of the jet stream rank as the most horrendous operations known to date. Operations so deceptive and diabolical, many protect themselves from learning more and remain in disbelief while they're aggressively deployed night and day in plain sight. However, sinister operations at this magnitude couldn't happen without a network of compliant people behind the scenes, from so-called environmental groups, Pentagon generals, propaganda media, NASA scientists, university professors, and TV meteorologists under gag orders. For many years on this show, guests have sounded the alarm about the many facets of real-time climate engineering conducted without public input or consent, deployed in silence, and under a false pretense of national security. We've also discussed how real-time, mass-scale geoengineering is the elephant in the room regarding the topic of climate change. A reality very few climate change activists are willing to acknowledge, learn about, and contextualize into their actions. In Other News has brought more voices to the airwaves, speaking on the topic of climate engineering than any other show on the Pacifica Radio Network. We listen to those voices who have fought valiantly to educate a heavily propagandized public. We begin with Rosalind Peterson. In 2005, I traveled to San Jose to attend a public meeting of scientists discussing geoengineering. I contacted Rosalind, who, with Bridget Conroy, founded the Agriculture Defense Coalition. We met for a live interview on the terrace of Hotel California. She explains her experiences, learning about the aerosol operations.
Well, I first got involved in 2002 when a friend of mine corralled me during a lunch break, took me into his office and said to me, essentially, if I knew if there was any crop dusting going on by the local agricultural department. And I said, no, because I used to work for them. I said, no, there's been no crop dusting in Mendocino County, California, where I live, for years and years. So he was concerned because it had been brought to his attention that there was some spraying going on in the county, and that he wanted to know. He thought if anyone would know about it, I might know about it. And so during the course of a short conversation, because it was my lunch hour, he took me outside and said, look up. And that's when I first saw the first blitz, where our sky was just covered with jets. I began to tell people about what was going on. They at first thought that I didn't know what I was talking about until they started to look up. And once they started to look up, then there started to be letters written, started to do more research, met a variety of people that in different counties and started to work with different people in different counties on the issue, and videotape and take pictures by the thousands and videotape by the hours and hours. And it was amazing. And so that's how I really got started on this subject. And I like research. And so part of it was that we all got together and started researching and looking at government documents. And early on, that's when I found out that a lot of people knew about this phenomenon. It was not uncommon. People have been seeing it since the early 90s, talking about it. But I think that my research showed that because they had used or coined the word chemtrail, that it began to make sense to me that it was part of a conspiracy theory, and that there was no definition in reality for the word chemtrail that anyone knew, but they just coined it. But because I found right away that the Air Force had listed this as a hoax, I realized that you weren't going to be able to go anywhere. And the first time I went to a meeting to talk to my congressman about this issue, bringing pictures And I met a friend there who had videotape of the same thing we'd never met before. And our congressman could absolutely not get away from us fast enough, because we were going to talk about this subject, and he didn't want to see the pictures, really, and he didn't want to see the tapes. He said, I've heard about this. He said, nothing to it. You know, it's fine. Everything's normal. We just have more jet traffic. Very dismissive. And from that time on, I learned very quickly that every time the issue was raised, even if I didn't use the word, I just had to talk about a persistent contrail or some other jet plumes or something, that right away, Senator Feinstein had the Air Force write a letter to me saying that everything was fine, it was water vapor and ice crystals, and it was normal, and therefore she didn't have to deal with it because she could just go to the Air Force and they would automatically write a letter, of which they've done a lot since, for these senators saying everything is okay.
As Rosalind Peterson found, everything wasn't okay. Rosalind's focus was on the effects of climate engineering on agriculture, the disruption of the natural hydrological cycle through climate engineering, and the raining out of dangerous soft metals from the aerosol operations into the soil and water. It's another linchpin in this nefarious plan for total domination and control of the food supply. Rosalind Peterson is among many brave individuals who fought against a well-funded perception management campaign. In this next hour, we hear from past guests, Dane Wigington with GeoengineeringWatch.org, Professor Doug McMartin, an MIT scientist, Cindy Bakulis, a researcher on geoengineering, Dr. J. Marvin Herndon, a nuclear chemist who tested soil and water samples and found they matched the fingerprint of coal fly ash, Patrick Roddy with StopSprayingUs.com, Wanda Allen, a citizen journalist researching geoengineering, and a few WBAI callers. What is the point of bringing in geoengineering into these international climate conferences? Why does it have to happen? Because it's happening in real time, but they're saying it, they're proposing this, and it's a fallback, a last resort. Can you explain that?
Well, first of all, they call it geoengineering, climate modification. Well, actually, there's two parts to geoengineering. One is carbon capture, where they supposedly suck carbon out of the atmosphere and bury it underground and, you know, think it won't bubble up like a soda stream. I don't know why, but anyway. And the second one is solar radiation management, preventing sunlight reaching the planet's surface to reduce global warming, reflecting sunlight back out into space. And when they talk about this, they only mention sulfates. They won't say, sometimes they'll say sulfuric acid. They won't talk about all the other things that they say are more effective. In fact, David Keith, who's another one of the cheerleaders for geoengineering, he wrote a paper back in 2010, the photophoretic levitation of geoengineering particles or some such. And in it, he said sulfates are ineffective because they coagulate and they fall out of the sky and they're the wrong shape and they don't reflect right. And what you really need to use is nanoparticulate aluminum, barium, and ferrite. And those are the things that we're finding in our rainwater all over the world. It's not just here. In fact, where I live in San Francisco, and we get prevailing winds off the Pacific Ocean. So I have 7,000 miles of clear ocean. I have some houses between me and the beach, but that there's no way that a little bit of residential activity is going to produce the very high levels of aluminum and barium that I'm finding in my rainwater.
The stuff that they spray in the lower atmosphere, it ultimately ends up in the soil, in the air we breathe, in the some of it going through your eyes, through your skin. It all comes down. It doesn't just stay up there forever. And it provides a source of aluminum when it gets wet. Aluminum in a chemically mobile form. Mm. Plants do not live comfortably in that environment. It's known to, from back in the acid rain days and from the studies that were made then, what happens to plants that are exposed. I mean, it kills forests. It's bad stuff. You can see that this is a toxic nightmare. And this is where the real deceit has come in, because I'm sure our lawmakers in all of their normal, not paying much attention to detail, never ask what's being put up there and how deadly it is. Or if they ask, they were lied to. Because who in their right mind would allow something as toxic as that to be sprayed on a daily basis throughout our nation and throughout the world, for that matter?
So I'm going to consider the calculations published by Robach. These were with the NASA model. He considered a control run for 80 years, a 40-year run with the IPCC A1B scenario, three different ensemble members so that he could average out all the variations, variability. Then he did two scenarios that I'll talk about here. One, inject in the Arctic lower stratosphere, 3 megatons SO2, and in the tropical lower stratosphere, 5 megatons SO2. And I guess he also considered a 10-megaton scheme. Now, the properties of the aerosols when you inject SO2 are have not been looked at. I was just talking to Deborah Weisenstein, who has actually done a calculation now with a full microphysics scheme. But what they've done is they've assumed the aerosol size is about 0.2 microns when it's dry. That compares to Pinatubo, which was 0.3 to 0.35. So it's smaller. And you might say that this could be achieved if you can somehow spread the injection out over time and not have a pulse that is very constrained, which would allow more coagulation. If you don't do that, and if you allow the particles to get too large, then you get lower heating in the lower troposphere. And that can change tropopause temperature, allowing more water vapor into the stratosphere, so which would have an additional heating effect.
When I first started researching, I was really focusing on the patent that was created in 1975 for powder contrail generation. And then there was another one in 1977 for creating combustible compositions for generating aerosols. And then the more you research and the more you look around, you find out, like you said, in 1927, they were looking at a process of producing smoke clouds from moving aircraft. In 1934, they had a patent for airplane spray equipment. In 1951, another one for controlling the weather. And even today, we have something like 66 weather stations for modifying clouds to increase rain, decrease rain, create drought conditions, where someone who is in the government that lives within that city can apply to have their clouds seeded. So all of these patents have gone back for a very long time. And they continue to make patents in regard to this as the equipment gets more advanced. There's one that was created in 1956, again, controllable dispersal device. I guess that improved on the previous one from 1927 and 1934. There are tons and tons. 1969 method and apparatus for seeding clouds. And it gets a little scary when you start to see the patents for aluminum in 1974, chaff dispensing system that the Navy uses.
So there is no question that whatever the aircraft are emitting is causing solar obscuration. That's exactly the goal of solar radiation management. Begin to test my precipitation to see if the elements named in climate engineering patents were in the precipitation. Indeed, they were in unimaginable quantities, starting with aluminum. Many people don't know that aluminum is a primary element in climate engineering patents because it's reflective. Spray aluminum into the atmosphere to block some of the sun's incoming thermal radiation with no regard for the consequences. So in regard to what data we have,
We have an immense amount of data, enough to start suing the Canadian government, which we are doing, enough to sue the U.S. Department of Commerce to get our Freedom of Information Act request from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which were not releasing their Freedom of Information Act request, which they are legally required to do. So if there's nothing to hide, why are they trying so hard to hide? And I'll finish with this, Jeff. If there's nothing to hide, why is there an illegal federal gag order on all National Weather Service and all NOAA employees? So people like Dr. McPherson are simply very willful tools of a power structure that wants desperately to hide climate engineering, and they seem to relish the part they are playing in that regard. Dr. McPherson seems to really relish the part he plays by telling the public, accurately so in this case, that the climate is imploding, that the planet's life support systems are imploding. But when he omits one of the single greatest factors in that equation, that's criminal, Jeff. That's hiding that from the public, and I would argue that's criminal for someone in his position that the public has entrusted with academic credentials, working for a university in Arizona, that for him to play this part is simply criminal denial at this point.
Patrick, you've been really active in attending a lot of these conferences, these climate conferences, mm-hmm. and you've been running into an old friend, Ken.
My buddy, my BFF.
Ken Caldera. I don't know if he still is, but he was the scientist with the Department of Global Ecology, Carnegie Institution of Washington at Stanford University.
He's still there.
He's still there. Okay, so I had, in 2006, I was at an event where a number of geoengineering scientists had convened and spoke about the potential of, using weather control. Ken Caldera was there. We had a nice conversation, and in that conversation he said, I used to work at Lawrence Livermore Lab, where we all participated in a meeting where we sat around the room thinking of ways to manipulate geophysical systems to use it as a weapon. Why did that impact you so much?
Well, first of all, here's a guy who's out saying, oh yeah, we want to spray this stuff in your sky to save you from global warming. But, oh, by the way, in the past, I was talked about, putting pathogens in the clouds. So, doing chemical and germ warfare. And I think you should actually roll that clip, because the banality of the way he says it is very chilling. Especially when he says, we thought, wouldn't it be just easier to drop the H-bomb on the city? And he says it so casually, as if he's like deciding which burrito to buy. It was just, woof. And this is a mass murderer at work. And yes, he doesn't fly the planes, I know, but he is one of the three guys who drew the short straw to go out there and sell this. And he is culpable.
Okay, Patrick, let's roll that clip.
I used to work at Lawrence Livermore National Lab, and I once participated in a meeting where we all sat around the room and thought about how could we manipulate geophysical systems to use it as a weapon. The meeting was about weaponizing geophysical interventions. That means, could you somehow interfere in Earth functioning in a way that you could use it as a military weapon? Could you change climate? What could you do in terms of manipulating the sort of Earth physical systems to as a weapon? Well, some of the ideas were okay. We could blow up hydrogen bombs, underwater offshore, and make a tidal wave that would go over a city. And the result was, isn't it easier just to drop the hydrogen bombs on the city? Now you could imagine, though, say putting pathogens in a cloud, let the cloud go over somewhere, and then would rain down on your enemy and create, do chemical or term warfare in this kind of way. And that might work against something that we say is big as the former Soviet Union, where, you could be pretty sure that within a few days that cloud would rain out.
The Dr. Herndon, I suspect you're one of the first well-known scientists to contribute to this part of geoengineering research. And as you know, the aerosol operations have been deployed aggressively, some say for the past 8 to 10 years globally, and it's covert. The public is not in the know. We're essentially lied to about the massive operations. What prompted you to speak out and publish research on this?
Well, when it became a near daily happening over my head, I wondered, well, what is the stuff they're spraying? And there was no information out there. Now, you mentioned the scientific community. And this actually goes back to my earlier paper on the corruption of science. The scientific community has acted in a most disgusting way. Science should be all about truth and finding a more precise understanding of nature. But the academic community, mostly university scientists and those research institutions that get a lot of money from the government, as do the universities, the scientists talk about geoengineering as if it is something that might need to be done in the future. Moreover, they talk about putting material to reflect sunlight high into the stratosphere, the upper atmosphere, and they do not mention what has been going on for, I would say, about 15 years, and that is the spraying of substances, the coal fly ash, I believe, and probably other things on an intermittent basis for purposes of experiment. This is sprayed in the lower atmosphere that mixes with the air that people breathe. And the academic scientists either have their heads in the sand or they're afraid to talk about it. It goes back to what I talked about, the corruption of science. The academic scientists, their proposals for research funding are reviewed by their competitors, and they're reviewed in secret. So over a half a century, since 1951, this has been the way it is. And so it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, hey, if you're trying to get a government grant, you don't criticize anybody's work. You don't do anything other than talk about the popular view, the consensus view. You don't challenge it because you might challenge somebody else, and they might get at you by giving you a negative review in secret. And so this has perverted the entire academic community. And it's not just in the U.S. Other nations adopted the National Science Foundation model. And so it's almost global that academic scientists just will not tell the truth if it risks their own funding.
It would be possible, if somebody really wanted, to develop aircraft that could deliver cargo up to the stratosphere. Those aircraft don't exist today. Nobody has ever thought about, or nobody has intentionally done that. But it's not, I don't think it's a fundamentally hard thing to do. It just hasn't been done.
Okay, we just refuted that as well. You keep using the stratosphere term, Doug. Stratosphere starts as low
as
23,000
feet. I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit concise. You're correct.
We see aircraft.
Nobody has been deliberately putting aerosols at 70,000 feet into the Earth's atmosphere.
Okay, I never said that. Have you ever heard me say 70,000 feet ever anywhere in 15 years of trying to expose this issue? Never have I said that.
But you have said that people are deliberately cooling the planet, and you haven't explained how people can put material at 40,000 feet and deliberately cool the planet.
I've never
the material just doesn't stay there long enough to make a big difference.
I think he's saying there's deliberate geoengineering being conducted
that's
in real
correct.
Time. It doesn't
that's
necessarily.
Correct.
Maybe they're trying to cool the planet, but that's not necessarily occurring.
It's possible that they're just inconceivably stupid.
Can we answer that one?
The only way that it is realistic to actually have a global effect on the climate is to put material at at least 60,000 feet and really more like 70,000 feet. And the reason for that is that the air up at that altitude is sufficiently stratified that the material stays there for about a year. If you were to put material at 35, 40, 45,000 feet where the airplanes can actually get to, that material only stays in the atmosphere for a week or two, and the amount of material that you would have to put to have a measurable effect on the climate is just truly, truly enormous and beyond the scale that anyone could conceivably do. So it is certainly possible for somebody to fly an airplane to 45,000 feet and dump some material there, but it's not going to have a measurable effect on the global climate.
Okay, let's, Dane, do you want to respond?
Wait a minute. Let's back into this. First, let's say not going to have a measurable effect on the global climate. You're saying putting tens of millions of tons, which is the stated goal of geoengineer David Keith, who I know you know and work with, his stated goal on the record, Doug, your listeners can look this up, Jeff, is to put 20 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates into the atmosphere. You're saying that that wouldn't affect the global climate? We have NOAA stating that the aircraft trails, whatever those are radically affecting the global climate. How can you possibly say it wouldn't affect the climate? Do you want to clarify
Dane,
that question first?
Dane, did you want to repeat back the previous sentence that I made about altitude?
No. You said that if they were putting materials into the climate at 40,000 feet, it would not affect the climate. How can you possibly make that statement? When you alter convection, Doug, I'm losing 60, 70, 80% of my solar PV uptake because of direct sunlight loss. When you cover the horizon and aircraft emissions are covering the entire horizon, how can you possibly say, when NOAA admits on the record, that that has a radical effect on the climate? Your only argument, Doug, is that you're talking about your definition of 70.
That has been made.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm interrupting you, and you're not letting me finish, Doug.
Hold on. Let Dane finish. Go ahead, Dane.
Your argument is what you describe as Douglas McMartin's personal definition of climate engineering occurring at 70,000 feet, and you know that that's not occurring. That's not what we're talking about here, Doug. That's not what we're talking about. Do you know or deny that David Keith has proposed putting tens of millions of tons of aluminum nanoparticulates, the most recognized geoengineer in the world, into the atmosphere? Will you acknowledge that?
I think that is a highly misleading statement on at least three counts.
Do you deny that?
I think
he
you
said
know
that?
It's a misleading statement. First of all,
I'm asking, do you know he said that?
I would say that is a highly misleading statement, and I think it would be the correct statement is David Keith wrote a paper that essentially asked the question of, hey, everybody normally talks about putting sulfate. Maybe you could do this with aluminum. And he wrote the paper, and I think the conclusion from that paper was, yeah, you could do it, but it probably wouldn't be a good idea. That's not the same as proposing something. It's basically asking a question and answering it. The amount of material that he was talking about, once again, he was talking about putting that sufficiently high into the atmosphere that you're up in the region where you have a residence time of a year, not in a region where you have a residence time of a week.
Let's go now to hear that clip of David Keith talking about aluminum particulates being sprayed out of jet aircraft.
A little picture is from a nanofabrication study, which shows you can make very high quality, and do this in just a jet in a very simple way, make high quality aluminum particles just by spraying aluminum vapor out, which oxidizes. So it's certainly in principle possible to do that. There's a big literature that's already looked at that. And you could do that by either building new versions of these aircraft or even re-engineering existing aircraft. So there's some ideas of that. So you go to an engineering firm and you want this done. They don't say this is hard or unusual. They say, okay, yes, we can do it. Aerosol geoengineering looks like it is so cheap that the cost is basically not going to be an issue. That means that implementation decisions will be risk-to-risk decisions. The risk of doing it against the risk of not doing it. And it makes the problem of how we govern it fundamentally harder and different than normal. So I've told you this, cheap to deliver materials to stratosphere, and I'm convinced that's true. I don't think that will change. But I think the more we do research, the less easy this will look, the more complicated the environmental effects will look, and that's a good thing. Because right now it looks too easy. So I think that if we do more research, we're likely to find out that it's harder and more complicated than we thought, and that the side effects are harder to manage, and that's a healthy outcome that will make it easier to do the management. Of course, the opposite reaction is possible. It's an empirical question how people will actually react to knowledge about this. Another reaction is to say, if these crazy scientists are so concerned about putting CO2 in the atmosphere, they want to think about these things, and that might actually mean we should be more serious about the risks of CO2 in the atmosphere. And by the way, it's not really a moral hazard. It's more like free riding on our grandkids. So let me be more careful here. We're to separate out the toxicological. So the alumina, we've only begun to research and published nothing.
That was you interacting with David Keith. Can you tell listeners about where that was?
That was at an international geoengineering conference. There was a room full of researchers and journalists, of which I was one. They allowed about 3 questions out of 100 in attendance. I was one of those questions. And the question I asked of Dr. Keith was, given his objective of putting 10 to 20 million tons of aluminum nanoparticulates into the atmosphere annually, had there been any toxicological studies been done? Human health effects, environmental effects? No. The answer was no. Nothing had been done. Could terrible things happen tomorrow? We don't know. That was his statement.
You've assessed that over decades, the goal is to perfect these mechanisms for dispersal in some ways. But then ARCO plays a very interesting role in all of this. Can you tell listeners about what you found out about this aluminum company?
Well, you know, it's funny because, as you're saying, a lot of it is based on these dispersal systems through airplanes. And there's so many fingers that branch out from this, because then you can start investigating biowarfare, which is, of course, spread through aerosols released from planes. And like you said, ARCO does play prominently in it. And here is another connection. BP bought ARCO, I believe it was in 2000. But ARCO was originally one of the 7 sisters that was broken up from Standard Oil in 1911, which was owned by the Rockefellers. And in that breakup, Exxon, Amoco, and a couple of others, Rockefeller maintained a quarter ownership of each of those companies. So when BP purchased ARCO in 2000, he was, in actuality, part of it was being purchased from Rockefeller. So, and ARCO was one of the original contractors for HARP, and that's also a connection, because HARP, as we discussed, is their purpose is to, you know, change the ionosphere and make it more of a plasma. And you do that through inserting barium and aluminum into the atmosphere. And ARCO also has its own company, which is one of the biggest aluminum-producing companies in the world. And when BP bought that, they also got that. So I guess it was an added. And BP, on its own right, is one of the biggest chemical companies in the world.
Hello?
Go ahead, caller.
Curious why nobody's really able to really come against them properly. Like, here you're on the radio. How do you combat somebody who believes in their heart that it's all right to kill millions of people because they'll come back in another life? You know what I mean? I'm just curious about that. You know? Why nobody really talks about the religious aspect behind it?
May not have been that difficult for you to find out about Bill Gates having 500 shares in Monsanto, and he promotes geoengineering. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, they're behind so many things, and they try to come off across as these, you know, incredibly giving and wonderful people, and he is one of the biggest advocates of geoengineering, and he talks about it all the time, and, you know, and funding, of course, David Keith, and I believe Ken Caldera is also supported by him, and also finding out that they are purchasing property out in California. So I think that's another big part of this whole weather modification thing, that people, you know, maybe they can come to it from that level, but the derivatives that are made on the Chicago Mercantile, and now these insurances that are put out against, so they insure a crop for, say, $5 million, and the crop, or the crop is worth $5 million, but they insure it for $10
million. Okay.
So are they better off to pay these weather modification companies to make it lose their crop or not lose their crop? So there's like this whole, and Monsanto bought this Weather Corp for just under $1 billion. They bought it, and it's a weather prediction company. And so they're making millions and billions of dollars off these failed crops or these hedge funds.
Why do I sort of premise this whole presentation as why I learned to love the Weather Channel, and how does this tie back to intelligence and using weather to create opportunity, actually? It's because there's this convergence that's going to be happening. And this convergence is a continuation of what obviously what's been going on for the past 40, 50 years in terms of technology and enhancements in memory and enhancements in the capabilities. But there's a couple of things that are coming downstream within the next 5 years that I think is going to have a big step change in our ability to both observe and predict the weather. And so a couple of these things that are called out here. One is something called GOES-R. And what GOES-R is literally the replacement for the weather satellites that circle the Earth right now, that have been up there for some 15 or 20 years. And what that will allow us to do is it'll allow us to see a lot more from space, about a 4-time increase in resolution. We'll be able to see things a lot faster. We'll be able to see things like lightning and fire, and it will give us a new level of granularity of data that will go into our computer models. And the computer models, like any model, and any predictive model, is only as good as the data that you put into it. So this data, this new GOES-R data, is going to result in a significant increase in the ability to observe this data.
So everything is this big matrix of pretending that they're for one thing and then finding out they're funded by the very people that are causing the action in the first place. So I never understood how environmental groups could not. First of all, because if you're really into the environment, how can you not look at the sky and notice that it's not the same sky that we have had years ago, and it's how horrifically it's changing?
Jeff, one other thing I wanted to bring up about the genetic Monsanto, the seeds and controlling our food in the future, it's all being perpetrated. I try to, in my own humanness, to deny that this is actually happening. One other thought I want to throw out there, because it's not being brought up. It's happening in real time. People are perpetrating this. Everybody who's listening in the air has to realize it's also a spiritual thing that's going on. I know I sound a little off the wall when I say this, but, you know, you sometimes got to wonder if, you know, this is going too far beyond human.
We have literally similar atmospheric conditions. Let me just get one point and you can answer it. Similar atmospheric conditions. We have grid patterns one day with east-west flights that do not exist commercially over our area, forming grid patterns literally. Next day, we may have nothing. We have film footage of jet aircraft leaving a trail from horizon to horizon next to an aircraft, similar altitude, leaving nothing. We have film footage of an aircraft leaving a trail from horizon to horizon that stopped as it was cut with a knife. We have photographs of novels on the aircraft.
What is it doing? What's the purpose of it? Like, what is it doing? It doesn't affect the warming of the Arctic. It doesn't affect the extreme weather events.
Listeners know from past shows and a lot of the research provided by Dane and others that geoengineering has been used, is currently being used, to create droughts and ruin farmers' livelihoods and as political punishment.
We wouldn't make those conjectures, though, Jeff. What we would state is this, that certainly that is a result.
The Real Inconvenient Truth by Vivian Workington. A person might be stoned for heresy in Berkeley if they were to question belief in global warming. But as a decades-long left-leaning KPFA listening and sponsoring, commuter bike riding, composting, plastic avoiding, bring your own cloth grocery bag environmental activist, I'm seeing too much hypocrisy and closed-minded smugness, and a lack of critical thinking on the part of those who I have always thought of as my people. I've come to the conclusion that those with liberal roots like me have been sent on a fool's errand, sucked into the unquestioning groupthink and religiosity by a well-funded corporatized environmental establishment that is scaring us into accepting top-down, pre-prescribed faux solutions that have never had public input and are designed to enrich bankers, diminish the rights of ordinary people, and funnel us into a controlled technocratic society. We hear plenty of talk about lowering parts per million of carbon, while basic principles of environmentalism are violated, such as don't pollute, do no harm, local control, conservation, recycle, reuse, live simply, less technology, not more. The democratic left has been hijacked and infiltrated, our ideals and beliefs distorted and twisted into a disciplinary social agenda, which demonizes rank and file humanity and deflects responsibility away from the real perpetrators of the destruction of our natural world. Al Gore, the man charged with popularizing the global warming theory, uses 20 times the energy of the average person in just one of his multi-million-dollar homes, yet his, quote, carbon footprint is never put under a spotlight. Few remember how, as vice president, he used his, quote, earth in the balanced environmental cred to stump for passage of NAFTA and free trade policies, which started the environmental race to the bottom, in the wholesale giving away of local power over land and laws to multinational corporations. Now, Gore is investing with partners such as Goldman Sachs in carbon trading schemes, espousing the self-enriching solution to a problem he defines. It would seem subscribers to the theory of global warming never question the designation of CO2 as the root of our environmental problems and its convenient, consequent value as a global taxable trading currency founded on the commodification of nature and a newly invented, quote, right to pollute. This unverifiable system run by bankers will accelerate, not slow, the pillaging of the planet. It is my observation that all aspects of the left alternative media, from the progressive weeklies to KPFA radio, are conducting the environmental wing of the global war on terror, never missing an opportunity to frighten and guilt trip us that we will cause, quote, game over for the planet if we don't vote for, quote, climate change legislation, aka carbon taxes and carbon trading, and support, quote, smart growth policies. We are schooled that only crazy right-wingers could possibly question the, quote, settled science and the, quote, settled remedies. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, is always cited as a trusted go-to body of expertise, even though their integrity was discredited with the, quote, ClimateGate scandal based on leaked emails in which head scientists at the IPCC, Michael Mann of Penn State, and Phil Jones of East Anglia University discussed doctoring the data on the, quote, hockey stick graph created by Michael Mann and punishing scientists and scientific journals that print contradictory evidence to the theory of global warming. So many now are feeding at the trough of climate change disaster capitalism that a rational open debate is almost impossible. City councils throughout the land are curiously all subscribing to the same developer, banker-enriching, land-grabbing policies of, quote, smart growth. Unelected, unaccountable regional boards made up of selected local officials, along with corporations and non-governmental organizations, are drawing up dictatorial regional plans for growth that supersede city governments, depriving citizens of the right to affect their own local land use policy. In the name of climate change remediation, we are told we must pack more people into smaller areas of land as our towns are being transformed into mega Manhattanized cities with tall, multi-unit apartment buildings that take our sunlight and ultimately our connection to the land and nature. Old buildings, neighborhoods, and communities are wastefully being torn down and made over to fit the vision of elite ideologue urban planners. In the upheaval, small, local, independent businesses are lost and replaced with national chains. This is not protection of nature, but a transfer of wealth, power, property ownership, and autonomy of cities, towns, and rural areas away from ordinary citizens. Today's, quote, environmentalists are working towards increased government and corporate control and surveillance over our lives through biohazardous technology, i.e. smart grid and smart meters, with no regard for thousands of independent scientific studies proving that digital microwave radiation damages biology. Instead of a call to decentralize, simplify, and conserve, citizens worldwide are being forced to apply, quote, smart meters to their homes, even as they are complaining of heart palpitations, extreme fatigue, mental confusion, sleeplessness, headaches, ear ringing, dizziness, and more. A technology is neither, quote, green nor, quote, sustainable if its byproduct harms humans, insects, plants, and animals. This unseen pollution from smart meters and smart grid infrastructure is increasing exponentially with no objections from official environmentalists. Unlike the old meters, smart meters use energy to power themselves 24/7. And I might interject and add, your energy is being used to power the smart meters 24/7. They are only advantageous to a centralized corporate model of energy control. Most shockingly, the left, who claim to have the corner on environmental stewardship, are the ones giving credence to geoengineering solar radiation management. That's the spraying of chemical nanoparticle pollution, such as aluminum oxide and sulfur dioxide via jet aircraft, into the atmosphere in order to block the sun, as a solution for global warming. On May 9, 2013, the Earth Island Institute sponsored a debate cavalierly dubbed, quote, Hack the Sky, at the Brouwer Center in Berkeley, California. The purported adversaries were Stanford geoengineer Ken Caldera and so-called ethicist Clive Hamilton, who belongs to the same geoengineering-promoting solar radiation management governance group with Caldera and other geoengineers. That very morning, two debaters made an appearance on liberal KALW's Your Call. A few months later, the apprentices on Progressive Radio's KPFA's Full Circle hosted the same performance duo. Why are environmental groups and left media putting on rigged debates, legitimizing and normalizing a preposterous technology which poisons and desecrates nature and can only cause irreparable harm, when they could be screaming warnings from the rafters that scientists are recklessly playing God with our world? These left media outlets are unconscionably frightening their following into accepting what amounts to nothing less than the corporate scientific intervention into our natural weather and climate systems. The environmental establishment chooses to ignore a whole area of inquiry relevant and crucial to the climate change equation, that of scientific, military, university, and governmental, NASA and NOAA experimentation with our atmosphere and weather, which has been going on for many decades. The book, Angels Don't Play This Harp, by Nick Begich and Jeannie Manning, documents the history of military experimentation with the Earth's atmosphere and chronicles the development, including 12 patents, of the high-frequency active auroral research project known as HARP, a field of giant antennas which can boil the upper atmosphere with a focused, steerable, billion-watt electromagnetic beam, sending electromagnetic waves back onto a target on Earth, causing changes in the jet stream and weather. The Department of Defense and their military contractors operate outside of all laws that protect the environment. Ironically, the climate change activists of today are listening to and trusting the very moneyed, powerful entities who have brought us to the brink of ecological collapse and forced us into fossil fuel dependency for diagnosis and treatment of our environmental calamities. I'm going to say that sentence again. Ironically, the climate change activists of today are listening to and trusting the very moneyed, powerful entities who have brought us to the brink of ecological collapse and forced us into fossil fuel dependency for diagnosis and treatment of our environmental calamities. The Rockefellers, one of the biggest funders and grant givers to the current environmental, quote, movement, have, throughout the decades, used their wealth and influence derived from big oil to remain in control of energy. They financed prohibition in the 1920s and 30s to keep farmers from making their own alcohol fuel and worked to criminalize hemp from which fuel was made. They killed the electric car and the municipal electric railways and influenced our government to suppress more than 5,000 energy technology patents, which have potential to end our energy crisis. The rhetoric we hear of creating economic and environmental equity among people and nations rings hollow when you realize that the environmental establishment is being bought and commandeered by the richest fat cats in the world who have the inordinate means to create equity overnight and to stop their destructive environmental practices if that were their true purpose. Instead, they're financing and manufacturing a phony grassroots campaign to pin the blame for environmental devastation on the, quote, every man who is living in a world choreographed by the corporate financial elite. Their message is that the future of the planet is impossible unless we, the little people, submit to the measures outlined by them. They have frightened, panicked, and demoralized the very people who would be fighting them with every breath into being the enforcement arm for their vision of our future. Fear of climate change is being manipulated to get the left to aid in the stealing of citizens' rights and the corporatization of our local government land, business, nature, and weather. While the environmentalists are stuck on climate change, the nuclear accidents, toxic spills, pesticide contamination, deep-sea oil drilling, fracking, tree cutting, electromagnetic radiation, introduction into the ecosystem of new dangerous technological compounds and organisms such as GMOs, synthetic biology, nanoparticles, the geoengineering of our skies, destructive war and weapons, and much, much more continue unabated. Now, left-wing pundits such as The Nation's Mark Hertzgard tell us to be impressed that the big-time financial fleecers and scammers, quote, Hank Paulson, hedge fund billionaire, Tom Steyer, and Michael Bloomberg, have come on board with climate change, as if they haven't always been. The war on climate change has gone publicly mainstream, as the likes of BP, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Dow Chemical bankrolled the People's Climate March in New York City in September 2014. No, it is way past time for the left to question where blind belief in billionaire banker-funded environmentalism is taking us. That was titled The Real Inconvenient Truth by Vivian Warkentin.
It absolutely astounds me. I think it's something like one out of three children has a disability right now, and I believe the quoted numbers are one out of 50 is autistic, but if you make yourself familiar with those numbers, the actual organizations that deal with autism are stating it about one out of 30. 3 years ago, it was one out of 300. 10 years ago, it was one out of 10,000. You're asking children to perform at such high levels, and unfortunately, and actually horrifically so, so many children have a disability. How is this possible? Well, it's possible if you blame the teachers and you say, you know, they're not teaching right, they need to relearn how to teach. I'm teaching 17 years, so what are you telling me? Everything I've done prior to this is wrong? So it's a scapegoat, and once again, what is wrong that our children have such disabilities that one out of 30 has autism? Like, maybe we should check into, well, geoengineering, vaccines, and all of the adjuvants that are in vaccines, fluoride, aluminum, all the horrific things that affect the central nervous system. But no, if you bring anything up like that, oh, God, you're a conspiracy theorist.
Though many in the public domain are educated about this topic and know with conviction, there are operations being conducted in real time that are engineering the climate. Others remain on the fence, while millions are in disbelief. These operations are done in secret, yet in plain sight. Some of the covert tactics used to deceive people include lying by omission, sock puppet TV meteorologists who call the aerosol operations high cirrus clouds. Listeners may recall the stated objectives for climate engineering were to buy more time, by reflecting sunlight back into space and mitigating violent weather. This as the societies wean off fossil fuel because fossil fuel emissions are thought to create greenhouse gases, causing the climate to get warmer. It's known that the truth of these operations are not within the governments, but within the contractors themselves working for government agencies, a loophole that allows for reckless operations above environmental protection laws and public accountability. A small group of controllers keeping various energy sources, such as zero-point energy devices, locked up. Meanwhile, the carbon tax programs, backed by highly controversial science, isn't being accepted by a scrutinizing citizenry. For example, you may recall in 2012, the Australian Prime Minister passed a carbon pricing scheme, but it was repealed 2 years later, July 2014. The people of Australia rejected the laying of financial blame at their doorstep. They rejected owning decades of unregulated industrial pollution created by billion-dollar globally owned companies. Many now realize we're living in a human stockyard, a controlled backwater of evolution. Our overlords move the goalposts when backed into corners with rational argument or observation. As you hear the shrill cries and caterwauls for a Green New Deal, pay close attention to who is behind the green mask, as author Rosa Corey expertly revealed. It's a long game agenda, the United Nations agenda for the 21st century, the 2030 agenda for sustainable development. Those agendas are pushing people into cities, into stack and pack housing, with so-called smart appliances, not unlike the experiment in Toronto called Sidewalk Labs, a community now known to abandon privacy protection for its new residents. That's going to do it for In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. Visit inothernewsradio.com for archives and more information about the guests.
The weather control and weather modification. Do you find errors in the forecast?
We are really good with making a forecast 48 hours out, 72 hours out, which is fantastic. Beyond that, I don't think we're all that great. I mean, I think we're in situations like, say, maybe the winter season, we're pretty good 7 days out. We can see a snowstorm coming or a blizzard coming, but. I'm a big believer in the chemtrails, and I'm very interested in looking at a study of that, because there's so much of it, and I think we need to definitely research that fact.